Good afternoon. My name is Amy, and I am here to hostess the 4-H show. I am a little bit late, and boy, I really love being part of a community radio station because it's my first time coming to the station when it was empty. And so I had to break in. No, I'm just kidding. I did not break in. But I was having a little trouble with the lock, so I called for help, and boy, the troops just showed up. It's amazing. Thank you so much, Tim, for running down here, and John for helping me on the phone. That's just amazing because I do hate to be late, but I am a Goddard graduate from Goddard College, and we used to always say we ran on Goddard time over there because every group study I was a part of started at least 10 minutes late. So I'm doing a little better than that. I was just 5 minutes and 57 seconds late today. But I will work on that. Now I know the code, so I'm in like Flynn. No problem from here on forward. So thank you for your patience. This is the 4-H's show, which is usually hosted by Jerry. But she's invited me, Amy, to come on in and fill in when she can't be here and co-host with her periodically. And what are the 4-H's? Well, they stand for health, harmony, happiness, and humor, which I think we can all agree on, I hope. so that's what we're here to celebrate today, and I've brought a lot of really great material. But first, let me tell you that the following program presents the views of its participants and producers. It does not necessarily represent the views of WMRW or its license holder, RootsWork. And it may not represent all of my views either, because I just like to share views of all kinds. And one thing that I'm really well aware of is how my views change all the time, you know, talking with people every day. I learn more from their points of views, and that broadens my point of view. And that's what we're here to do, I think, especially on community radio. So it is definitely my honor to be here. And we do have some sponsors. We have Super Simple Foods, offering homemade soups and fresh bread daily. And you can find Super Simple Foods at the Mad River Car Wash at 124 Finders Green in Waitsfield, Wednesday through Saturday from 11 a.m. until 3 p.m. Oops, and I have more. Let me find those in my notes here. Oh, Whippletree Designs, and they have Vermont souvenir apparel for all ages. Whippletree Designs is located at Mad River Green Shopping Center in Waitsfield. And you can reach Whippletree Designs by calling 802-496-9694. And you can also follow them on Instagram under Whippletree Designs. So, I came running in here in a flurry, but I have a lot of really great stuff that I'd like to share with you. I have some news from across the pond. Some people say that Europe, and especially, you know, the United Kingdom, is across the pond. That means across the Atlantic Ocean. And actually, over the weekend, I met someone from across the pond, and I got some news from over there in the United Kingdom and how they've been faring through these COVID times and these COVID restrictions. And I was really heartened from what I learned is going on over there. It was really great to hear that the people are still caring, and they are waking up there just like they are waking up all around the planet. And so that's really what I've come to share with you is this word of this message of hope. I really see how people all over the world, it's really truly amazing, are coming to these same realizations that living in fear is unhealthy, and so choosing love and compassion is really a great place to start. So there's a woman over in the UK, and her name is Anna Breeze, B-R-E-E-S, Anna Breeze. And she was a programmer, what am I saying? She was a journalist for the BBC, and she has recently gone off on her own. And especially in terms of COVID, and during these times of COVID, She has taken on a special project of teaching people to become, get this, drum roll please, citizen journalists. Isn't that fantastic? Citizen journalists, which, you know, I really think that's a great idea, because if we really want to come to a better understanding of what is going on out there on the streets, right, then we need to hear from real people. And increasingly, the mainstream media, the media that is owned by corporations and controlled by corporate profits, and basically following, you know, just government programming and agendas without question, and censoring any discussion on the subject or anything that doesn't follow the party line, the more and more that the mainstream media is going in that direction, the more important it is that we hear from actual human beings on the planet. And so this first one, I think I'm going to bring these citizen journalist reports from Anna Breeze. I'm going to bring them occasionally to this 4-H show, just one at a time, so that we can practice hearing from our fellow humans. And I feel like these citizen journalist reports that Anna has collected are just really, really instructive to where we are at as a human species, and just what I was telling you about, this awakening of hope and love that is happening, and truth that is happening, is just such a beautiful thing that I have to share it with you. And so this first one that we're going to hear from, this was, like all of the other ones I'm going to play in the future, recorded in 2020, the year 2020. So in the very beginning and of this COVID lockdown, COVID restrictions, COVID mandates coming down around the world, universally, unilaterally, everywhere. So we all got to share in this experience. So isn't it cool to be able to hear how our friends across the pond have been experiencing it? So thank you for joining me. I have a little music first, which I would like to play. Let me see if I can get this in the right order here. If I just do this, there we go. So first of all, I have a song from Anne Weiss, another Anne Weiss, who is not from across the pond. She's actually spent a lot of time hanging out around Goddard College, which is where I came to know her. And she just has such a beautiful voice and such beautiful music. So we're going to get in the mood to come on into my kitchen, you know, which is a great place to have a chat with a friend, to get us in the mood of chatting with a friend. And then we're going to hear from a new friend of ours from across the pond, because she has an important message that she'd like to share. Thank you for joining me.
You better come on into my kitchen, because it's going to be I'm not afraid to
Hi Anna, my name is Karen Richardson and I'm 46 years old. I'm a daughter, a wife, a sister, but most importantly, I'm a mum to these two little boys right here. And, you know, I remember back in the day, it took me a long time to fall pregnant with my boys. I had multiple miscarriages. And wondered, you know, even at some points, am I doing the right thing, bringing children into the world? And you know, that was back 8 years ago. And now, you know, I'm asking that question again, because I thought, no, you know, I'm going down the wrong path here. You know, the world's going to be a much better place moving forward. And fast forward to 2020, and I can see nothing but a bleak future right now. I am terrified for the future of my children. It's not so much about me. It's not so much about us adults, because we have had, you know, a life. But they are purely innocent. I have literally spent the last few months shielding them from the ridiculous levels of fear that are being pumped out everywhere. I won't take them shopping with me. Thankfully, I've got a wonderful husband who takes that load and he does the shopping, so that the kids don't have to be confronted with the crazy fear factor that's just being, you know, spewed out in the eyes of people, you know, jumping out your way, you know, wearing masks now. I just can't get my head around it. I don't understand why people aren't looking at the actual figures. Why aren't they looking at the actual figures and saying, hang on a second, this doesn't warrant what has happened thus far. This doesn't warrant the lockdown. This doesn't warrant mandating masks at the end of a pandemic. At the end. Why isn't anybody asking themselves, oh, so why weren't masks mandated at the peak or at the beginning? Why weren't they mandated then? And we've watched the curve decline while people were not wearing masks, right? They weren't wearing masks in the supermarkets. I mean, there was maybe a small percentage, maybe 1% of people were wearing masks in the supermarket before it was mandatory. And yet the numbers declined while we were all shopping together without masks. All the media, you know, there's even a clip of Dr. Hillary going around, who's the puppet on GMTV for the, you know, this narrative, this false narrative, saying, oh, it's ridiculous wearing masks because the particles, virus particles, are nanoparticles that would just literally sail through the gaps in the masks. And when you breathe, the air is going to go in the top and underneath and round the sides, unless it's a medical grade, specially fitted virus mask, which none of them are. None of them are that people are wearing. They are just there to perpetuate more and more fear. And I find it terrifying. I find it terrifying that people are just falling into it because they're being told to do it. I'm terrified that this so-called vaccine, and, you know, I really am angry about this whole labeling of calling people anti-vaxxers, because they're using their brains and they're saying, hang on, if all other vaccines take 8 to 10 years to develop, why would we want to rush towards one that has been, you know, developed in months or maybe a year at the most, when it does eventually come to pass? You know, it's crazy. The last vaccine that was rushed through was the swine flu vaccine. Now, just go and look up swine flu vaccine damage. Just go and look it up, okay? You will see that mainly people in the NHS were maimed by that particular vaccine. Okay, frontline healthcare workers were the ones who were mainly maimed. And there's been suicides as a result of the, it was narcolepsy, I believe, that it caused. But it caused severe brain damage. You know, some people died from the vaccine. Just investigate these things. I don't understand this whole blinkered attitude. And that's what scares me the most. You know, for back in 2017, I went through a very, very traumatic period in my life when my mum was in, she had a very bad head injury and she was in a coma, and she was given a 3% chance of coming out alive or, you know, with any kind of brain function. And I'm a great believer in the power of healing, in the power of love, and the power of, you know, that positive, loving energy, you know, working for people. And this is the direction we all need to go in, because what we are witnessing is fear, fear, fear. Fear is a very, very low energetic vibration. And thankfully, because it is a low energetic vibration, and it's up, it's actually up here in your head. There is not a big, you know, it is contagious, but it's not as contagious as actually love is, because love comes from the heart, and we have a huge magnetic field that comes out from the heart. And this is where we all have to go towards. And just to go back to my story, so my mum had this 3% chance of pulling through. And we received so much love from people. And, you know, I was up seeing her every single day with my dad. And she pulled through. And she's not 100%, but she's probably about 85, 90% the person, you know, she used to be. And then a couple of weeks later, after my mum came out of hospital, my dad, he had a double pulmonary embolism and blood clots in his heart. And the doctor said on his arrival to the hospital, you should be dead. He shouldn't, you know, once they'd done all the scans and everything, that he should not have even survived the journey. And again, you know, I do believe that there is a much bigger power out there looking out for us. And then finally, it was in the December of, and this was only another few weeks after my dad got out of hospital. It was my little boy who was 5 years old at the time, and he actually ended up with a ruptured appendix. And, you know, all of them survived. All of them were critical. All of them, you know, at least my mum and dad, you know, they should have died. And my little boy, he was critically ill. You know, critically ill. But thank God, every single one of them has pulled through and they're all fine. But I think about that and I think, what if that had happened now? What if that had happened in 2020? Would my mum have just, you know, they'd have just switched the ventilator off. I'm absolutely sure of it. They'd have just slapped a DNR on her. And that would have been that. And my dad, he would have been put in a COVID ward because he couldn't breathe. And it wasn't. It was, you know, a pulmonary embolism. And that probably would have finished him off. And then would I have been able to have been with my little boy in hospital? Now, I don't know the answers. And I don't want to put a slight on healthcare workers, because I know the people, every single one of them, they're beautiful people for them. You know, the majority, the huge majority are wonderful people. And they go into the profession because they care and because they want to heal. But what's happening is compromising them. It's, you know, putting them in difficult positions, but they've got to come forward and speak out, because what's happening isn't going to impact just us and our families. It's going to be your families. And I'm talking to all frontline workers, like the police. Are you going to enforce those new laws? Because your child has suspected COVID at school, are you going to be the one to come down and take them into quarantine away from their family? Terrified child who's then going to go into care. Are you going to do that? Or are you actually going to stand up and say, it's rubbish? Not saying there isn't a virus, but what I am saying, the numbers don't add up. The numbers don't add up. These cases that you're seeing, there's more tests. The PCR test doesn't even test for COVID. It tests for coronavirus, which is also the common cold and other flu bugs. I just hope to God people start to see what is happening here just by looking, not going down any conspiracy theories, just look at the figures and start questioning why this is happening, because there's no justification for it. And Sweden proves that. No justification for it. It's less deadly than, you know, the flu. And in 2018, it was far worse, with a flu epidemic that nobody knew about and nobody was scared of because you weren't told to be. Coming back to love, we've got to come back to our hearts. We've got to come back to our hearts, and we've got to come back to compassion. And you've got to start seeing actually from your heart, because it was that told me things were wrong. You know, it didn't take someone else to tell me. I intuitively knew something was very, very off with this whole thing. And, you know, I saw someone else say the words conscious revolution. Yes, that's exactly what has to happen here. You know, we're not going to do this with hate and with violence and with pointing at other people and calling them names, you know, whatever place they are at. You know, you got to remember they're stuck in fear. And that's a horrible place to be. I was there for years myself until I realized it wasn't real. And when you realize that the fear isn't real and that what we're being told isn't real, that's when you'll start to wake up and see the truth. But yes, we need people to start standing up, especially frontline workers, especially NHS, police, military. You know, you're the people who are going to be expected to carry out all the dirty deeds of these rushed vaccinations, of these, you know, taking people into custody for not wearing masks, maybe, or, you know, taking children away from their families. Can you really do that? Can you live with yourself and do that? And can you then accept that if you're doing that to someone else, someone might do it to you as well? Please, I beg, for the sake of the kids everywhere, please just start looking beyond the media and what they're telling you, and the government and what they're telling you. I don't know why they're doing it, but it's not about the virus. That I do know. You know, I have my own theories. I'm not going to go into that now because it's irrelevant. The fact is, it's happening, and that's the truth. And we need to stand up together. If enough of us stand up and say no, and we just have to stand up with peace and love in our hearts and compassion and say no. Not me, not my child, not that person's child, not any children should have to grow up in this world of fear, control, dictatorship. None of them. So that's really what I want to say. I didn't know quite how I was going to say it until it came out. So thank you for listening. And I just pray someone watches this and it just triggers something inside of them.
Well, there we go. A little news from across the pond from a couple of years ago, 2 years ago. That citizen journalist, I'm sorry, I don't know her name, but you can find her video and others on Anna Bree's pages. She's got them all over. I don't know which sites she's been kicked off of. I don't know if YouTube is still carrying her, but it's Anna Bree's, B-R-E-E-S. And partly why she is encouraging people to become citizen journalists is because more and more of real people's experiences are being blocked out of the mainstream media. And Anna Breeze is very familiar with that, having worked for the BBC and seen firsthand how that happens. And then especially through this COVID-19 response, we've seen an incredible clampdown of censorship. We've seen entire subjects that are really just common sense questions people have just being completely censored, ignored, and anyone who raises them is often ridiculed, shamed, shunned by their own neighbors, by their friends, by their family. So, you know, of course, who would want to go ahead and keep speaking after they've had those experiences? Well, that's the intention, right? And so it's turned out that people, no matter how they're viewing this situation, they are often feeling a lot of fear. And fear is one of those negative emotions, along with anger and blame, right? And jealousy and laziness and all these other negative emotions that actually shut down our thinking brain. It actually makes it impossible for us to think and use our reasoning abilities when we feel those things. So there has been this magical thing happening, I've noticed. It's magical. It's like we're in this crucible, right, of pressure from all directions. And what it's doing is I'm seeing people literally transform into diamonds of humanity, just diamonds. And we're all sparkling and shining in our own unique ways. However, fundamentally, the core, the hard rock that is, you know, strong enough, you know, to scratch glass and everything. I mean, a diamond is super strong. And that strength, that core that people are having to find because we need it so badly, is love and faith. And so it's really been a beautiful thing. And so I certainly want to encourage everybody to try. Try finding that love and faith. Try reaching out across the pond or across your street or across the checkout counter and see how the person on the other side is faring. And just opening our hearts, because one of the things I've been most concerned about is how, you know, the mainstream media message of fear has really caused a lot of people to shut their hearts to others. And while they may be, you know, laser focused on the concerns in one area, it's eclipsed their ability to understand and relate to others in other areas. And I'm seeing this as a real class issue in particular. People who are having to live under these mandates and work under these mandates are suffering. And people who sit behind desks all day or perhaps are retired or, you know, perhaps, you know, don't have to follow these mandates or maybe are in great physical health, don't seem to understand how tragic it's been for others. And so my perspective, my name is Amy Hornblass, and I am the author of the Vermont Mask Survey. And you can find the Vermont Mask Survey, which is a survey I conducted across the state of Vermont, gathering evidence of the harms of one particular mandate that was implemented, the use of masks in response to COVID-19, the use of masks in community settings in particular. And this is one area that that I've really done a deep dive on. But what I really think the skills that I use to do this deep dive you know, are skills that anyone can have. And just like the woman we just heard from across the pond in England, why wasn't anybody looking at the figures, right? Looking at the numbers. Just look at normal flu deaths and what normally happens with the flu and compare it to what we've just been through. And it's really not that different, especially if you consider the fact that that the CDC has been reporting influenza-like illness, pneumonia, and COVID cases all together. And then if you whittle down into what's a COVID case, according to the CDC, it reads like legalese. It's basically like a basket that almost anybody could fall into. And then you look at how they determine, you know, the PCR test. And once you start teasing it apart, you just start to scratch your head. And that's what most people have actually been doing through this, is kind of scratching their heads, going, this isn't adding up. We're going to do a little bit of a deep dive today because on my website, I also have a couple of lesson plans. So you can go to Vermont Mask Survey's website. It's VT, like Vermont, vtmasksurvey.com. And when you get there, you can pull up lots of information. I have information about reading scientific studies. And I also have a cheat sheet on there, which we started to go over last time I was here. We're going to do a little bit more of that today, because I'm really trying to help people understand, you know, why is there very little evidence of effectiveness on masks and really no evidence that they're safe. And most people find that surprising. I just heard from a very well-educated woman who I totally respect in a meeting I was at a couple of weeks ago, and she said something like, well, of course there must be a mountain of evidence that masks are safe and effective. Of course, because why would we have these mandates otherwise? Well, that's an assumption, and we know what happens when we assume, right? It makes a you-know-what out of you and me, and so I'm just asking folks to check that assumption, right? Let's just check. Let's check all of our assumptions, basically, at this point, on everything. And so if we look at what the World Health Organization has to say about the evidence of masks, they say very clearly, and they said this immediately, and they are still saying this today, there is no direct or high-quality evidence that of their effectiveness in the community setting. They say There is only limited and inconsistent scientific evidence to support the effectiveness of masking healthy people in the community to prevent infection with respiratory viruses, including SARS-CoV-2, which is the virus that, causes COVID. So with any respiratory virus, including this one. And so I did find it a little disturbing yesterday when I met an old friend, and you know, she understood, you know, that of course people should have the choice to wear masks, of course. But then she said something like, you know, well, I would prefer if someone with a cold did wear one when they're around me. And I just kind of cringe, because where did that understanding come from? Right. That's a total misunderstanding. There is no evidence that they help with colds. In fact, the only evidence we have is that they probably spread things like colds and other viruses and bacteria. So take a deep breath, folks, because I know that these concepts can sometimes bring up strong emotional reactions. And of course, we know that those strong emotional reactions make it really difficult to reach across the pond or reach across the street or reach across that checkout counter and relate to the other person who may feel differently. And so let's think clearly. Let's really dig into this. Why does the World Health Organization say that there is no credible evidence? Well, if we look at how we can read studies, last time I was here, we looked at the different types of studies, or I talked about the different types of studies, and this is all on a cheat sheet on the website, vtmasksurvey.com. And types of studies, you know, whether it's real-world studies or not real world studies. Those are the kind of the two pots that we can put types of studies and research into. And basically, we have no real world evidence that masks work. And all we have for real world evidence is pointing to a lot of hazards that come with wearing them. And we'll get into that. So that's what we talked about last time. I'm going to move on right now to step number two. Okay, after you've determined what type of study or research you're looking at, how about reading the conclusion? Well, yeah, a lot of people do that, right? That's maybe the only step on this whole list that most people will do. If they do look up a study, they go right for the conclusion, right? So it is important to read the conclusion very carefully, making note of the study's focus, how it was conducted, and precisely what the author's conclusions were. Now, unfortunately, a lot of people stop here. However, without continuing on to the next steps, the conclusions are meaningless. We need to consider the other variables to understand how reliable the conclusions are. And so conclusions are basically a summary of what the researchers who conducted the study have to say at the end of their study. They may have missed something, very likely, right? They may be just aiming at one aspect of it. And in their conclusion, they may not have included other aspects that are really important to take into account. And also, they may use words that, you know, imply one outcome from their research, but is the evidence really there? And what I've discovered, it's really heartening to me that scientists don't appear to be lying about any of their evidence. They don't seem to, I have not found evidence that scientists are actually ever lying and actually totally misrepresenting what they found. However, they'll use words like may, right? Masks may help prevent the spread. You know, and so, well, you know, the moon may be made of cheese too. I mean, that's not a false statement. And I know that's an extreme thing to say, but you know, if you have any experience reading legalese and really drilling down to what does that sentence actually mean and how could it be interpreted, you need to kind of keep that open mind. It is sort of similar to reading these research studies. And so I have an example here. this is also up on my website. It's on the tab that says evidence masks. Oh, wait, wrong one. Evidence masks are effective. Okay, so the effectiveness of masks, what exists out there? And I have one example, and it is, I'm sorry, the tab is CDC study of effectiveness. It's the CDC, one of the CDC's latest studies that they came out with recently. I guess it was in 2021, and it's about, you know, are masks effective? And if we read the conclusion that they came to, this is what they state. Mask mandates were associated with decreases in daily COVID-19 case and death growth rates. period. Okay. Mask mandates were associated with decreases in daily COVID-19 case and death rates. That's true. They did find an association. Okay. And so if we drill down into the study, and I link to it on my site, I want you, do not ever take my word for anything. Do not ever take anybody's word for anything is my advice. I advise people and suggest and recommend and hope and pray that people will read it for themselves. You know, if it's a theory you're really going to hang your hat on, you're really going to, you know, maybe impose mandates on other people and impose restrictions on other people that they don't believe in, then just take a little time to check your facts, right? Why not? Why not? Read the actual study and see what it says. But I'm going to share with you, you know, what I found, and you can double check and see if I was right. So when I read the study, what I discovered is they looked at 100 days of data. And I forget where they looked at it. Okay, so this was an epidemiological study. They were looking at data from a population. And they looked over, which is basically 3 months, say just over 3 months worth of numbers. And what they were looking at is 100 days after the mask mandates were imposed in these certain U.S. counties. The report's modeling found, you know, when they added all these counties together and put them through this mathematical equation that would kind of balance them all out and come to an average, what they came out with was a 1.8, so not quite a 2% drop in positive cases, and a 1.9, so almost a 2% decrease in deaths in these numbers that were reported in these counties. Okay, so first of all, we have to ask, like, how dependable were those numbers? You know, what are we counting as deaths? What are we counting as cases? And there are a lot of questions about that. But let's just take this at the face value. Let's just say that they were very good numbers. They're as solid as we can get right now. So we might as well go with them and just see what that means. Well, how conclusive is this evidence? Well, first of all, was this study peer-reviewed? No, it was actually published as an early release in the CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, what they call their MMWR. And get my clock back up here. The MMWR does not necessarily put their studies through a peer review process. The CDC explains that they have their own peer review process, their internal peer review process, and it's reviewed by CDC staff. Now, this is their words, in order to be sure that the results of the research conform with CDC policy. Okay, so that's their peer review. Their peer review is not to see if it conforms with, you know, the body of evidence that exists out there from other researchers, whether it conforms, you know, what other standards that peer reviewers put it through. No, in this case, the CDC only makes sure that it conforms with policy. So I think that's kind of an important thing to note. It's a mathematical model, which means it is not real-world evidence. And it's an epidemiological study, which we talked about last time, which means it is not, you know, not something to hang your hat on. It can give us a hint, but it's not conclusive in and of itself unless we find some real-world evidence to go with it. And that's because correlation does not equal causation. Just because those numbers appeared to drop, now whether we can say that's a statistically significant amount, less than 2% over 3 months, you know, even if they did drop, if those numbers dropped, you know, does that mean it was because of the masks? Well, in fact, there are some other questions as far as that is concerned, because first of all, during that period of time, there were other restrictions in place, of course. There wasn't just mask wearing, there were lockdowns. I mean, people simply weren't traveling, simply weren't mingling, and that would, we all know, you know, cut down on the spread of all kinds of germs and bacteria. We also, you know, people were hand washing more. I'm sure they were being more careful about everything during that time for the most part. And also, this was a selective time frame. The 100 days that they chose to study were the time period when we would expect flu cases to drop. It was going into the spring and summer, which is when we would naturally expect a decrease. In fact, you know, might expect a greater decrease than 2%, you know, going into the spring and summer. And usually flu and, you know, cases drop off to almost nothing, except amongst, you know, severely, you know, people who are especially vulnerable to that kind of thing. So really, if we go back to our original question, is a 1.8% drop after 100 days of wearing masks significant, you know? So, okay, let's say it is, because of course we want to avoid all deaths. I understand that. And we want to avoid all illness. I agree. That is my mission as well. However, anytime we implement any type of health measure, we must constantly be comparing the effectiveness against the costs. All right, so that's called a cost-benefit analysis. And it is a key, crucial step. And that is what I've been asking in open letters to Dr. Levine, the Agency of Education, everybody I can think of, our Government Accountability Committee there at the Senate, in the legislature here in Vermont. I have been asking everybody, my school board members, my librarians, and everybody, please, let's just do a cost-benefit analysis. Because even if we were able to bring down COVID, you know, deaths and COVID cases by that much over 3 months, at what cost? Okay, so we're talking about 100 days of mask mandates. And what does that look like and feel like to the people who are living under them? That is the one thing that the mainstream media will not allow a discussion on. And so on my website, I have a tab that's called Evidence Masks Are Safe. So let's look at that. What, you know, if we do have a 1.8% benefit or a 1.9% benefit after 3 months, what are we risking? Okay, we should always be looking at that. And we do have OSHA standards. That's the health and safety standards that were developed in our government that employers need to follow. These OSHA standards were developed over a long period of time based on the fact that employees were dying and becoming ill because of a lack of safety in the workplace and because of inappropriate safety measures that were put in place or inadequate or even dangerous safety measures, such as respiratory protection devices. This is a type of PPE, some people call it, but it's, you can find these standards under OSHA 1910. These are the OSHA standards relating to respiratory protection devices, and they are very specific. And the reason is breathing is a super important body function. Okay, this is just basic biology, of course. Respiration is the most important function of the human body. Breath is life. It's literally what it means. If you look it up in the dictionary, breath is life. It's the first thing we do, and it's the last thing we do. And the health of every part of our body is dependent on good respiration. It's super important. And that is why any restriction of breathing is going to, of course, cause some health effects. And so we have these specific OSHA standards in place. And what are these OSHA standards based on? Well, they aren't just pulled out of a hat. They are based on the known best evidence. And so on this tab, Evidence Masks Are Safe, on the website, vtmasksurvey.com, you can find a nice breakdown of what evidence does the CDC provide to reassure us that masks are safe. And I'd love for people to read that. Please look, because the one thing I've been asking for is, what evidence do these decision makers have? What evidence does your employer have that the respirator, the mask, the cloth mask, the paper mask, or the actual N95 or dust mask style respirator — those are technically respirators, the N95s and dust masks — they are OSHA approved, they have gone through, you know, the testing to know that they can protect against certain things. Does your employer know that those are safe for you to use? Well, it turns out it is, according to OSHA. It is their duty that if they even allow you to voluntarily choose to wear a respirator. That's an N95 or a dust mask type respirator. If you voluntarily choose on your own to wear one at work, according to OSHA, it is your employer's responsibility to determine that that respirator in and of itself does not create a hazard. And they have very specific guidelines on how to go about that, which includes a medical screening for you and everything else to make sure that you have enough health to wear it and that you are taking enough breaks to keep breathing to make sure that the carbon dioxide that is building up under that mask is not causing you too much damage, that the lack of oxygen that you are now, your body is now receiving as a result of that restricted breathing is not going to cause, you know, long-term damage or even short-term damage. That feeling of suffocation that people have when they wear masks is very real. It's actually real. It is our body's way of saying, help, I need to breathe. And so telling people that they shouldn't listen to that or shaming them for bringing it up, I don't know what to say about that. I guess people aren't looking at the evidence. So why aren't they looking at the figures, like our friend from England said in the beginning of the show? Well, let's see. What is the evidence that the CDC has that masks are safe? Because I always encourage, go to the source. Go right to the source. Go to credible sources. And we can talk more about that if you're interested on what are credible sources. Let's go to the CDC and see what they have to say. Well, interestingly, the studies that they share do not in any way demonstrate safety. In order to understand what kinds of evidence they've presented here, I need to take one moment and talk about blood oxygen meters. Because the only evidence that these studies have to say that masks are safe is based on this blood oxygen meter, this one way of looking at the body and its response to restricted breathing. So what is a blood oxygen meter? Has anybody here ever gone to the doctor or the hospital and had them put one of those little clips on your fingertip? And it's like a little clip and it's a little monitor. And what it's monitoring is how much oxygen is in your blood at your periphery. How much oxygen is flowing through the blood at your fingertip. And that number, as it turns out, according to OSHA's original respiratory handbook from the 1970s, that monitor is not how you tell. Okay, they explain very clearly in OSHA's original handbook about these devices, about respiratory protection. Blood oxygen levels are absolutely not the place to look for difficulty with getting oxygen into your body. And that is because our bodies are made to maintain that homeostasis, to maintain that level of oxygen in the blood so that it's greater than the level on the other side where your cells are through osmosis and diffusion accessing that oxygen. So that level in your blood has to stay relatively stable or else you're in big trouble. I mean, if your blood oxygen level actually drops, you're gonna probably fall down, okay? And so if every time your body needed more oxygen and the supply was not readily available at that second, if your blood oxygen level dropped every time that happened, then every time you ran across the room, you would fall down, right? Because your blood oxygen levels would change every time your exertion level changes. But instead, our bodies work really hard to keep that blood oxygen level stable so that we can run across the room. And instead of falling to the floor when we're not getting enough oxygen, we do what? What do we do if our body needs more oxygen? Well, we breathe harder. We breathe faster. Our heartbeat increases, right? Because now we're trying to send the blood faster. And so our body has these other compensatory mechanisms to make up for that. And that's what our bodies are relying on, because for a millennia, those were the conditions we were in when we were struggling for oxygen. We were not covering our faces. So this is a new thing, to be covering our faces and then therefore not allowing that rapid breathing, that increased heart rate, to do its job. So if we look at these studies that the CDC has gathered as evidence that masks are safe, will notice two important things, and that's all I have time for today. One of them is that the only evidence that they present that masks are safe are these blood oxygen levels, which we just described how that's not where you look. And the second thing they do find is evidence, and they warn. If you read the studies, they give very clear warnings that this evidence is troubling. They do find evidence of increased heart rate, increased respiration, increased blood flow to our periphery. That means that our fingers and toes, our cells are opening their mouths and saying, you know, not their mouths, I'm being dramatic, but, you know, opening up and saying, give us more oxygen. So the blood is flowing more heavily to our extremities to try to keep our organs alive in an environment with high levels of carbon dioxide, which is another thing they find in these studies, high levels of carbon dioxide, which is toxic to our bodies. It's really important that we are able to exhale that carbon dioxide and get it away from our mouths and noses so that on the next inhale, we can bring in the oxygen that we need. I mean, it's very simple and it's very basic, and so it's something that actually most people understand. So thank you, folks, for allowing me to come in here. This is such a pleasure, and explain these basic truths. You know, I'm trying to find a place where we as humans can all come together with love and compassion for each other and reach across whatever divide we have invented artificially between us, and realize that we are all in this together, and that if we work together and listen to each other and actually care about each other, we can make a lot of positive change in the world. So my name is Amy, and I've come to the end of the 4-H show, but I want to let you know I'm going to do the top of the hour here right now, because I am going to stick around. All right, I have a little surprise for folks if you have more time, which I have more time, and the next programmer doesn't come in for a half an hour. So I'm going to do a little bit of reading again today from The Real Anthony Fauci, which is a book by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. So if you have a moment, stick around. But first, let me tell you that you are listening to WMRW 94.5 FM on your dial or at WMRW.org. And you can find the current live broadcast at WMRW.org. You can also go on that website, scroll down to the Spinatron link, and if you click that Spinatron link, you can then go back for 2 weeks worth of programming and re-listen to shows. I know I've been having a blast at my house listening to WMRW currently, what's on the air, going back and listening to all the awesome music shows you have. And Tim, who was just here, his show is fantastic. I'm always catching that. So I really encourage folks to take advantage of technology, because it's just fantastic that we can come together and do this. So let me take a little music break, take a sip of something, and then I am going to spend about 15 minutes or so reading from The Real Anthony Fauci by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. For a little bit more context of where we are today. All right, so how about a little bit more Anne Weiss?
Sitting in a tree, neither one wants to sing to me. One won't speak and one won't say, and this is the world that we have made. 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 But don't ask me if it's too late. But don't ask me if it's too late. Two birds sitting in a tree, has a bow and one has a blade. And this is the world that we have made. This is the world that we have made. A world that we have made. A world that we have made. Don't ask me if it's too late. Don't ask me if it's too late. Take these wings and mend these things. Take these wings and mend these things. Take these wings and mend these things. The concrete world and the lover's dream. The concrete world and the lover's dream.
Right, folks, that was Anne Weiss from her Concrete World and the Lover's Dream album. That was the title track. And so this is Amy, and I'm coming back for just a few stolen extra minutes to read from The Real Anthony Fauci, Bill Gates, Big Pharma, and the Global War on Democracy and Public Health by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And I started reading a little bit from this last time I was here, and the reason why I think this is so important is because a lot of people like me, and you know, were startled when this concept of using masks and lockdowns and all these measures that have all these negative effects, I mean, huge amounts of negative effects, in order to address this one problem, I mean, it didn't even seem like an effective way to go about it. I was wondering why every media outlet and government on the planet pretty much agreed suddenly that these were great ideas and that there was no discussion any further. And I was left scratching my head. How did that happen? In a democracy, where we have the scientific method, and that includes scientific debate and basic biology and all these things. Well, this book really helped open my eyes to the fact that this is not a new thing. These ways of responding to the COVID crisis were not instantaneously invented in response to COVID. They have been laid out and practiced through these scenarios that these groups have been doing, that with a lot of funding, they have been planning and preparing and training the media and the governments to know how to respond, and to respond in specifically this way, with lockdowns, masks, and vaccines. Those were the three things. And just so folks know, the masks are my issue. That's where I have drawn the line, because, you know, I can see the harm. The lockdown was bad enough, and then when the masks came along. And so this book goes into a lot of the other subjects, which is really important for us to hear about. So this last chapter of the book is where he really gets into these role plays, okay? And there were several, many, many of them, and I don't have time to read all of them, but if you read this last chapter, you'll see an outline of every one. But I'm going to start with one of the most recent and one of the last tabletop exercises before the COVID-19 response, to kind of put this in context of what they were prepared to do and perhaps why. This role play that they did was called SPARS, SPARS 2017. And you can look this up. You can find the SPARS handbook online. You can read it yourself. You know, what was the handbook they used for this tabletop pandemic exercise? So this is Kennedy now writing. SPARS 2017. 5 months later, In October 2017, Bill Gates convened yet another tabletop pandemic at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, the Global Biosecurity Command Center. Gates Foundation, along with NIAID and NIH, are major funders of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. SPARS 2017 chronicled an imaginary coronavirus pandemic that would, supposedly, run from 2025 to 2028. The exercise turned out to be an eerily precise predictor of the COVID-19 pandemic exactly 3 years later. Building on the Pentagon's anthrax simulation in 1999 and the intelligence agency's Dark Winter roleplay in 2001, Atlantic Storm roleplay in 2003 and 2005, Global Mercury roleplay in 2003, Schwartz's lockstep scenario document from 2010, and Mars in 2017. So these were all previous roleplays that Kennedy actually gets into previously in this chapter. The Gates-funded SPARS scenario war-gamed a bioterrorist attack that precipitated a global coronavirus epidemic lasting from 2025 to 2028, culminating in coercive mass vaccination of the global population. And as Gates had promised, the preparations were analogous to preparing for war. Under the codename SPARS Pandemic, Gates presided over a sinister summer school for globalists, spooks, and technocrats in Baltimore. The panelists role-played strategies for co-opting the world's most influential political institutions, subverting democratic governance, and positioning themselves as unelected rulers for the emerging authoritarian regime. They practiced techniques for ruthlessly controlling dissent, expression, and movement, and degrading civil rights, autonomy, and sovereignty. The Gates simulation focused on deploying the usual psyops, retinue of propaganda, surveillance, censorship, isolation, and political and social control to manage the pandemic. The official 89-page summary is a miracle of fortune-telling, an uncannily precise month-by-month prediction of the 2020 COVID-19 pandemic as it actually unfolded. Looked at another way, when it erupted 5 years later, the 2020 COVID-19 contagion faithfully followed the SPARS blueprint. Practically the only thing Gates and his planners got wrong was the year. Gates' simulation instructs public health officials and other collaborators in the global vaccine cartel exactly what to expect and how to behave during the upcoming plague. Reading through the 89 pages, it's difficult not to interpret the stunningly prescient document as a planning, signaling, and training exercise for replacing democracy with a new regimen of militarized global medical tyranny. The scenario directs participants to deploy fear-driven propaganda narratives to induce mass psychosis and to direct the public toward unquestioning obedience to the emerging social and economic order. Now, I just want to take a moment to just remind folks that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is a very, very experienced lawyer, and he had an entire team of lawyers help him write this book. And it is annotated. Every single statement he's making in here is followed up with a reference. And he's had this book on the market for, what, about a year now? And he has not been sued. Okay, so what this tells us is that really nobody can really argue with what he's saying here. You know, maybe his interpretation, but we're all free to make our own interpretations. But the facts are facts. Okay, I'm going to continue reading. According to the scenario narrative, a so-called SPARS coronavirus ignites in the United States in January 2025. As the WHO, the World Health Organization, declares a global emergency, the federal government contracts a fictional firm that resembles Moderna. Consistent with Gates' seeming preference for diabolical cognomens, the firm is dubbed Synbio. It's C-Y-N-B-I-O. Oh, I see. Synbio. That's how you say it. To develop an innovative vaccine using new, quote, plug-and-play, quote, technology. In the scenario, and now in real life, federal health officials invoke the PREP Act to provide vaccine makers liability protection. So I don't know, I'm going to stop for a moment too. If folks don't know what the PREP Act is, that is an act, a law that actually makes vaccine producers exempt from lawsuits. So if you are vaccine injured, you do not and cannot sue the manufacturer. You have to sue the U.S. government, and it's the taxpayers who will pay for your damages if you win. Okay. Another company in this scenario receives an emergency use authorization for a remdesivir-like antiviral that federal officials previously evaluated as a therapeutic for SARS and MERS. So according to the scenario, by late January, SARS has spread to every state and 42 countries in record speed, a coalition of ingenious corporate and heroic government officials miraculously produce a new vaccine, CoroVax, just in time for a July 2026 emergency use authorization rollout. This medical marvel meets resistance from several nuisance groups who complain that the companies have not adequately tested the jab. I know a lot of people have trouble with that word jab. I do find it a little startling too, but that's sort of what people have come to call it. Okay. Among these ingrates are African Americans, alternative medicine enthusiasts, and a rapidly growing members of an anti-vaccination movement who bellyache on social media. But government and industry leaders depicted in those 89 pages have plans to silence and censor these dangerous elements and to crush all resistance. The SPARS team responds with a flood of propaganda to drown doubt with vaccine plugula, public shaming of the vaccine hesitant, and patriotic appeals. While allies in government and the media boost public acceptance with propaganda, impose censorship, and muzzle dissent, Gates' minions recruit trusted, quote, interlocutors, quote, familiar community and medical leaders to mollify the public that the experimental, unapproved, hastily tested, zero liability vaccine is. Can you finish? What do you think the slogan is that they chose? Come on, you've been hearing it nonstop for 2 years. Come on, we can all say it together. 1, 2, 3. Safe and effective, quote. The most effective interlocutor is Dr. Paul Farmer, Harvard's esteemed medical anthropologist and co-founder of Partners in Health, which provides medical care to impoverished regions around the globe. The simulation report states, quote, Paul Farmer, the renowned global health expert, lauded the safety and efficacy of CoroVax and underscored the dangers of SPARS. His only regret, he said, was that the vaccine could not yet be made available to everyone on the planet. The real-life Farmer lists Gates as his organization's top funding partner, by the way. By springtime 2026, with the EUA vaccine rollout in full swing, public reservations about the vaccine are multiplying. The scenario blueprint predicts waves of severe neurological vaccine injuries soon appearing among children and adults. Okay, this is in the role play, guys. I just want to remind you, this is the role play where this is happening. The CDC is meeting escalating skepticism toward its exaggerated predictions of coronavirus lethality. official fatality number indicates that coronavirus mortalities are comparable to the seasonal flu. If I can back out for just one more second to tell you, I recently saw a clip of Bill Gates. He actually has admitted in a recent interview that, yeah, our models were overblown. COVID-19 turns out to have been more like the flu. So that's in real life. He just recently said that. But in the role play, they also admit that, interestingly. And then it says so this is right out of the role play scenario booklet. It says, by May of 2026, public interest in SPARS had begun to wane. In late April, the CDC had publicized an updated case fatality rate estimate, suggesting that SPARS was only fatal in 0.6% of cases in the United States. And then Kennedy notes here, note that the 2020 COVID-19 case fatality rate was a mere 0.26%, according to the CDC. So even lower than this role play was saying. And in the role play, it was comparable to the flu. So there you go. The SPARS organizers warn that dropping death rates will spark, quote, public sentiment widely expressed on social media that SPARS was not as dangerous as initially thought, end quote. This perilous drop in popular fear jeopardizes the vaccine enterprise. So the SPARS team turns to pandemic porn. That's funny. Pandemic porn. That's just funny. Consistently repeated death counts and case counts to amplify the panic decibel so as to assure the success of their mass inoculation program. To overcome the public's dangerous complacency, the CDC and the FDA, in concert with other government agencies and other social media experts, begin developing a new public health propaganda campaign. And here's right from the document itself. It says, create a core set of messages that could be shared by all public health and government agencies over the next several months, during which time the SPARS vaccine could be introduced. In a section headed Food for Thought, the scenario challenges participants to devise their own strategies for disabling common sense so as to achieve broad vaccine coverage. So here's what the booklet is encouraging participants to do. How might federal health authorities avoid people possibly seeing an expedited SPARS vaccine in development and testing process as somehow, quote, rushed and inherently flawed? How might federal health authorities respond to critics who propose that liability protection for SPARS vaccine manufacturers jeopardizes individual freedom and well-being? What are the potential consequences of health officials over-reassuring the public about the potential risks of a novel SPARS vaccine when long-term effects are not yet known? Even a casual read of the Foundation's planning document makes clear that Gates' preparation has little to do with public health and everything to do with limiting freedom and aggressively marketing vaccines. Well, I'm going to have to stop there because I am out of time, but thank you for joining me. I was just reading from The Real Anthony Fauci by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and while this section was focused on vaccines, he does explain how these scenarios begin with, of course, the lockdowns, and then, of course, the masks. And this is sort of where this all came from and how we got here from there. Thank you for joining me. It has been really my pleasure to come in here to WMRW. It's a great station, and thank you for supporting them in every way that you do, you listeners out there, because, of course, I know community radio depends mostly on you. And thank you for listening. Thank you for having an open heart and an open mind. And I have one last song here by Ella Jenkins to get us out, and I will pack up and leave. And there's another wonderful music programmer coming on here in just a moment, so please stay tuned.
This is a tune called Trouble in Mind by Richard M. Jones. Richard M. Jones was a band leader in and around Chicago. He grew up in New Orleans, but did most of his stuff right in this great city, Chicago. And I'm glad to be here with Ella Jenkins while we do Trouble in Mind.
Trouble in mind, I'm blue, but I won't be blue always, 'cause the sun's gonna shine in my back door someday. Trouble in mind, I'm so blue, but I won't be blue always, 'cause the sun's gonna shine in my back doors someday. Let's hear you, Irwin. Trouble in mind, I'm so blue, but I won't be blue always, 'cause the sun's gonna shine in my back door someday.